It's a good time to ask, now you're in the mood. Did you know that Neil Armstrong was married to the Queen of England?
Are you sure?
Yeah. Be an inventor.
First man to walk on the moon. That'd be something.
We've chosen a job so difficult, requiring so many technological developments. We're gonna have to start from scratch. Only after we master these tasks do we consider trying to land on the moon.
Neil, if this flight is successful, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that?
We're planning on the flight being successful.
This isn't just another trip, Neil. You're not just going to work.
Do you think you're coming back?
There are risks, but we have every intention of coming back.
Somebody got a Swiss Army knife?
A Swiss Army knife? Are you kidding me?
Here we go.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
We have serious problems.
We've got this under control.
You're a bunch of boys. You don't have anything under control.
First Man, the movie, starring Ryan Gosling as Armstrong and the regal Claire Foy as his wife, the star who played the Queen. And today we'll recall how ABC Science covered Apollo 11, and we'll visit the University of Tasmania. We'll also see how investment in data science could help Australia make $300 billion, and then why primary school kids should learn about Einstein and relativity. Peter Pockley founded the ABC Science Unit in 1964. Only 5 years later, he was faced with the biggest broadcast imaginable. This is how it was done.
For nearly 4 years, an electronic umbilical cord joined me to the Apollo astronauts. Our umbilical was a simple voice circuit, a pair of wires, if you like, with the occasional communication satellite joining the loose ends. It brought together the voices of the astronauts, put them through the placenta of Mission Control in Houston, Texas, and carried the combined sounds to me and my colleagues in the ABC Science Unit here in Sydney. Unlike the biological situation, though, our umbilical flowed in one direction only, from them to us. Frustratingly, we had absolutely no communication the other way. We were simply eavesdroppers on a stream of voices, some earthbound, some spacebound. These were carried on a private line which Mission Control kept open continuously to the tracking stations throughout the world. The line was dubbed, rather grandly, the Voice of Apollo. I learned of its existence after struggling to present adequate broadcasts of the first manned flights of the Apollo project. Apollo 7, which orbited the Earth for 11 days in October 68, and Apollo 8, which took three men around the moon on Christmas Eve of the same year. For those broadcasts, we patched together whatever actuality material we could understand from the wheeze and whine of shortwave broadcasts. For me, and I'm sure for our listeners, we were just mildly interested observers of the space game, from a distance and in disconnected snatches. We did try to improve things by getting our correspondents in the US to lift the sound from American broadcasts and feed that to us by the compact cable, at no small expense to the ABC. But this was very cumbersome to set up and could not provide the authoritative and locally relevant information needed for Australian audiences. But all that changed for our broadcasts of Apollo 9, which in March 69 went into orbit around the moon and test flew the lunar lander, and Apollo 10 in May, the exciting dress rehearsal, when the lunar lander Snoopy swooped down to and around the grey mountains of the moon. For these broadcasts, we obtained an exclusive phone tap of the voice of Apollo as it passed through Sydney to the tracking station near Canberra. And because it didn't cost us a cent, the pontiffs of the ninth floor were in no pickle about our virtual full-time occupation of a studio. We linked the voice of Apollo into what we, in turn, rather grandly called the ABC's Apollo Studio, and at least one of us listened to it without break throughout every day and often throughout the night. When we didn't broadcast live the predictable key events, we recorded every other moment, including large chunks of hiss, or hash as the jargon had it, in case something vital was missed. Oh, this incidentally was how he managed to beat probably every radio station in the world with broadcasts within minutes of the explosion on Apollo 13 during a dull period of transit to the moon in April 70, and how radio stayed for days with a heart-stopping story of bringing Jim Lovell, Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes safely back to Earth. Well, the audio quality of the voice of Apollo was just electrifying. And as we relayed in our broadcasts, the clipped voices of the astronauts and controllers, seldom betraying any strain or emotion, it riveted us and our growing audiences. It was a true radio event, and for later missions, of course, also a television event. But I like to think that radio was king, because we not only packed our broadcasts with live drama and information, but the very sounds of voices from space were the seeds of countless millions of imaginary journeys to the moon by the eavesdroppers. The later television pictures from the moon and the rather crude gee whiz presentation they got from the studios tended, I think, to diminish and eventually demolish that imaginative element. As I clocked up the days and nights of listening to the voice of Apollo and interpreting it on air, I got so involved with the men out there that intuitively I could feel precisely when, after a period of hash, they were going to speak, and almost what they were going to say. My extrasensory game with the astronauts was never to speak when they did. This was all good training for the big one, for Apollo 11, of course, when I was to lead the most extensive and complex live broadcasts ever staged by ABC Radio for days at a stretch. I was hooked up to two sets of headphones and had every conceivable backup for variety and safety in case the voice of Apollo dropped out, including the ABC's first and probably only live open telephone line for talkback, without the regulation 7-second delay to protect sensitive ears from expletives or profanities. A senior executive had agreed to our requests for great chunks of airtime because, as he put it, broadcasts of the moon landing and walk would be the greatest thing since sliced bread. But pity me if I spoke when the Eagle landed on the moon, or when Neil Armstrong decided to deliver his little script as he dusted his boots with lunar soil. I didn't. On listening back to some of our broadcasts, I think they do reflect the tenor of the times. A mood pervades this oral record, which no volumes of the printed word can adequately recall. We laced our broadcasts with loads of straight information about the what and the how and the why of it all. Our listeners seemed wrapped in the medical, the chemical, the physical, the technological, the statistical, the geological, the electronic information we poured out in between the moments of tension as the astronauts passed yet one more dangerous moment. There was little of today's emphasis on the social relevance of science and the so-called evils of technology. There were cynics about the space game, and at the time I was fairly sceptical about the benefits of taking men to the moon. It seemed to me then that only the geologists needed to have trained collectors on the moon, and that all other significant experiments could eventually be done by remote control with unmanned vehicles. I thought, and still hold to this view, that we didn't have to have such an expensive rush. It could still have been achieved at a slower pace, without the letdown, and the widespread critical backlash against technology in general, which followed NASA's rather overblown exercise in self-justification. The technological spin-offs were real, but they probably spun more in the direction of the military than the civilian uses of space. Yet, I was in continual contact with some outstanding civilian scientists who were independent souls and were quite enormously excited about the observations of man on the moon. To me, I guess these people provided the major justification for the whole exploit. And fortunately, they were generous in sharing their feelings with the millions of non-experts. And it's this that makes me feel that if men were going first to the moon today rather than 10 years ago, we'd probably be hearing broadcasts of the event in much the same way as before, though with somewhat less excitement and certainly less optimism.
The late Peter Pockley in 1979 and his pioneering leadership was recognised with the award of the Medal of the Australian Academy of Science in 2010, presented by the then Governor-General, Quentin Bryce.
Founder of ABC Science, Dr. Peter Pockley has a fine chronicle of accomplishments in science writing and broadcasting. But he swept up a nation that day back in July 1969 when his voice delivered us to the moon. It gives me goosebumps today. Ladies and gentlemen, I am privileged to present such an honour this evening, and I sincerely thank the Academy and Fellows for your guardianship of human existence and well-being, my friends.
The Governor-General Quinton Bryce with the Academy of Science, and congratulations to Peter Pockley, who's been many times on this science show. And this is how Peter Pockley described the moon landings way back then.
There's some movement now occurring. Some movement of Armstrong.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
He's moving down the ladder. His face onto the ladder.
Okay, I just checked getting back up to that first step. That hasn't collapsed too far, but it's adequate to get back up.
Roger, we copy.
It's a pretty good little jump.
He's checking his step, checking his balance on the step, moving down slowly and steadily.
Buzz, this is Houston, F2, I'm at 1/160th second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
Okay. Martin Royal has joined us for this description of the spacewalk.
The ladder, the LEM footbeds are only...
We can certainly see one of the lunar boots
depressed in the surface about...
moving downwards, just how far down, it's not quite apparent.
Very, very fine-grained as you get close to it.
How many steps are there, Peter?
I think there are 9 steps. I think it takes 11 movements altogether before actually stepping on the lunar soil.
There's the boot again.
Waving out in space as he feels around, awkwardly.
I'm going to step off the LEM now.
One hand on the ladder.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
One small step for man, Armstrong says.
Yes, the surface is fine and powdery. I can kick it up loosely with my toe.
He's got a foot on the powder.
Neil Armstrong.
In fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and sides of my boot.
Neil Armstrong has set foot on the moon.
You've heard it 1,000 times, but that was real history. It brought millions of young people to a career in science. Peter Pockley, who died in 2013.